is Hyperspace Theology, exploring what we can know about life and faith and God Almighty through a galaxy far, far away.
I do have to say, we are lacking in the Funko Pop department.
Do you not have any Funkos, Scott?
I do. I got the Bad Batch.
Nice.
Oh, do you?
Yes.
I've got Knights of the Old Republic. I've got some of the concept art Funkos, like the Ralph McQuarrie characters. I've got the Cantina Band.
Nice.
And I've got all the Cantina creatures. So I've got all the Cantina characters. I've got Han and Greedo and Ithorian wearing a swimsuit. It's actually based off the old like Kenner action figure, but I like to call it his one-piece swimsuit. I've got Ponda Baba, Muff Tack, you know, the big white guy with the eyes drinking his milkshake, and with his little tendril.
Proboscis,
that's right, it's proboscis. And then I've got, what's that, a Jawa. Baby Yoda eating a frog, Qui-Gon, a Porg, Chewie, old Luke. Right here I've got all my bounty hunters. The issue is you can't see any of them from here.
I've got Super Saiyan Goku right here.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
See, that's the thing. A lot of my friends were into Dragon Ball Z, but for me, I never quite got it.
That's okay.
I never quite fit.
That's
okay. It just wasn't my thing.
I am not judgmental about that.
Well, you know what is my thing? Hyperspace Theology. I'm very excited for us to get into this episode. Welcome, everybody, to Hyperspace Theology. This is, after all, a show in which we are exploring theology through the lens of a galaxy far, far away, from belief to redemption, orthodoxy to resurrection. The Star Wars galaxy is jam-packed with theological themes, and we're going to crack them wide open. Hopefully this can be of help to you in your journey of faith, or at the very least, can enhance your appreciation for the galaxy we all know and love. I'm your host, Jared Mays. I just got through with a youth group cookout and had my first glass of orange soda in maybe 5 years. You guys have a favorite pop? I'm a guess. Dr. Kevin Burr from Texas. Feels like Dr. Pepper would be a very Texas thing to drink. You a Dr. Pepper guy?
That's a very Texas thing to drink, but I'm not a Texan per se. I'm a Tennessean. I think just regular old Coca-Cola or A&W root beer. That's me.
Ah, A&W, that's good. Now, when you went to Harding, let's see, was the A&W still there?
It was. And I ate there, and that was the first date. That was the place of the first date of my in-laws. Yeah.
Wow. How about that? That's cool. I thought you were going to say your wife, and then you took it back a generation.
Back a generation, yeah, because my wife, man, she just had no interest in me when we were in college.
We love you, Kevin. You know who else we love? Mr. Scott Howland. Scott, I'm going to guess that you're a Moxie guy. That's a very main drink.
Absolutely not. I'm a ginger ale guy.
Good choice.
Ginger ale. Now, Kevin, have you ever heard of Moxie? Do you know what? I hate root beer. I despise it. It's disgusting.
I have had Moxie. I was traveling about 5 years ago, and I was in Kennebunkport, Maine, and tried Moxie.
Okay. Yeah.
Woof.
That might be the only place you can still get it. Possibly.
It was not.
Listen
good.
To this, Scott. I found Moxie in Arkansas the
wow.
other day. I did not buy it. I did not drink it.
Smart man.
I did take a picture and text it to my wife.
I was hoping you were going
to
say that Moxie
was
a salty old lady at your church or something.
Moxie, how would you describe it, Scott, for our audio listeners? This is a weird thing to be describing pop on a podcast. You know, a very auditory
podcast
medium. And here we are.
Ooh,
oh, there it is.
Watch out.
I would describe Moxie as Coca-Cola if you hate yourself.
It seems pretty fair.
Coca-Cola if you hate fun. I've got another theory that people, Mainers especially, they drink Moxie.
Just in spite of everybody else, mainly.
I think they drink it because they think they're hardcore. I'm a Mainer.
Yes.
I'm a wicked awesome drinker. I don't know what that, I'm yeah. trying.
You're pretty good for a guy from Arkansas, so.
Thank you. This morning in Bible class, everybody was making fun of my accent. I said something with the letter O, and I put this little Boston kind of a W at the beginning of my O's. And I realized, like, that's something I kind of picked up on accident in Massachusetts. Well, let me know, listeners, if you can detect a little bit of New England accent. After all, we have some very eclectic backgrounds here. Kevin's got the PhD, lives in Texas. I just finished my master's and live in Arkansas. Used to worship with our good buddy Scott Howland in Massachusetts, coming to you from three separate states, three different walks of life, and yet we are united by the galaxy that we all know and love, as well as the blood of Jesus Christ our Lord. So tonight, Scott, you chose the topic. I'm very excited about it. I think it's a juicy one. Let's get into it.
Okay, so I'm pretty sure if any of our listeners are on Facebook, they may have seen this post floating around. It's a quote from Dave Filoni, and he says, "Stop thinking of the..."
Who is that?
Excuse me?
I'm kidding. I said, who is that? Well, I'm joking.
Go ahead, Scott. If you don't know who that is, you're listening to the wrong podcast. "Stop thinking of the dark side as some pathway to power. That's the Emperor lying to you. It's destructive. Vader is miserable. He lost everything. He has no one in his life. Absolutely nothing until his son comes and says, 'I love you.' Other than that, his life is a wreck. That's not the way to live your life. I see a lot of adoration. I get that the bad guys are cool, but they are evil. You really don't want to be them." So I saw that, so I'm starting to think a lot about, and of course, coming on the heels of Obi-Wan, there's no bigger personification of how miserable Darth Vader is and how really lonely he is sitting on that stone throne in Mustafar, not really having anybody, you know, to just have a drink with or anything of that nature to pal around with. You know, it's like all business all the time, but there's somebody above you still dictating what you should be doing and should be thinking in your quest for power and your quest for whatever your personal MacGuffin is. And so, you know, I got to thinking about that in real life, that some people like to take shortcuts. And, you know, instead of putting in work to get to where they do, lots of people put in their work. Mm. Lots of people do that. But there are people who take shortcuts and quote, make deals with the devil to try and advance themselves to whatever their personal MacGuffin is in the world. And so I thought that might be an interesting topic for us to kick around for a little while.
I've got to admit, I was surprised by this post. I expected you to take it a different direction. Because it seems to me that there's a really broad appeal in our culture for erasing the distinction between good and evil, right and wrong, light and dark. It seems like we want to embrace the shades of gray, and this could just be my own experience. Not popular to say there's binaries, there's right and wrong, good and evil, there's a correct way to live. There's a destructive way to live. Jesus remarks about there being a straight and narrow way, and the way is wide. The way is wide. The road is broad that leads to destruction. The way is narrow. The path is hard that leads to life. Very few will find it. Those kind of words seem at odds with our culture, from my point of view. And so to hear somebody actively involved in the creative side of Star Wars saying, that's no way to live. Don't take it as something appealing and enticing. Take it as a cautionary tale. I find that surprising because it seems countercultural, right? What do you guys think?
And part of what I was like kind of ruminating about as I'm thinking about these things is a lot of times you see in Star Wars that people who are on the Emperor's side, they don't last very long. They grab what they can, but someone's right behind them to grab what they have, and that just seems to be the full cycle of what the dark side like embodies. And even when you look at Reva, who uses the dark side for the dark side process of getting revenge and trying to get revenge, I guess. She fails. You know, and she can't.
Sure.
She's at odds with everybody else, even though she's using the dark side for what the dark side's there for. So, and then I'm often thought it kind of clicked for me and this is a cue up Kevin here, Yoda in Empire Strikes Back when you know he's talking to Luke about the dark side, and he's like, no, it's not stronger, it's just quicker, and it never really sunk into me until I like kind of read that and then looked over like Obi-Wan and looked at what Darth Vader's life had become in Obi-Wan, and so I found that kind of interesting.
Yeah, definitely. Well, you wanted to hear Kevin's impression.
That's kind of what
I brought my Yoda with me today. I found him in some old toys.
What is that? Like a 2-inch tall toy from your childhood?
Some friends from church donated a bunch of stuff to my boys, and in the midst of a bunch of lightsabers. Yeah, it's like a little 2-inch Yoda. So
the only Yoda I have is this, I call him the catcher's mitt face Yoda from the original episode 1. The puppet, it's a disaster. It was sheer nightmare fuel. Unlike your impression, which is lovely.
Scott, you raised some interesting, really interesting issues here, especially with this quote. I think one of the things that we have seen, and as soon as you started talking, I was thinking about Reva, is that we saw in her a perfect case in point, a perfect example of what it is that the dark side does to people. Vader's a good example. Reva's a good example. I'm trying to think of some other examples. I mean,
Maul. Maul is just an absolute disaster of being alone and miserable and tries to bring everybody down with him.
The only reason why I didn't go to Maul first is because with Reva and Vader / Anakin, we know what they are like to some degree before they become Inquisitor and Darth Vader. We know what they're like. There are so many times, especially in the Clone Wars series, where, man, you are rooting for Anakin, even though we know where it's going to go. We know how it's going to end. We are rooting for him to be the best good guy he can be. And there are moments where he is just extraordinarily kind. Ahsoka gets to see the absolute best of him and comments on it occasionally. We know from watching Obi-Wan that Reva was just a bright-eyed youngling in the temple. And they both ended up becoming the thing that they hated. And I think that's one of the real tragedies of the dark side. That's one of the real tragedies of evil. Today, I've seen it happen to a number of Christians, unfortunately, who, in their religious zeal, are adamantly opposed to X, Y, and Z, you know, positions or, you know, trends in society or types of people, etc. And they have some kind of conversion or deconversion / conversion experience. And they are every bit as zealous. And yet all of their zeal is now turned against what they once were. And it's really heartbreaking to see that kind of thing. And I think that evil just looks at that and says, my job is done here, because you have become the very thing that you hated. What does Obi-Wan say about Anakin? It was prophesied you were to destroy the Sith, not join them.
Yeah, definitely. It's important that we don't lose sight of what it is to have Christ-like behavior, even if we're trying to fight against evil, even if we believe that we're on the side of God and we have His word and feel like we stand on the side of the right and stand in the light. If we act with darkness, darkness can't cast out darkness. Yeah, that's a great point. Very sad. I was just having this conversation with elders and ministry staff today, in fact, about how we're going to engage with a certain difficult topic. And we're going to treat it from the pulpit? Are we going to treat it in Bible class? Somebody said, if you so much as say that word from the pulpit, people are going to hear whatever they want to hear. Doesn't matter what you say about it. I said, yeah, it may be true. That may be true. So how do we deal with this? And one of my coworkers said something along the lines of, we're called to show the love of Christ, to spread the good news about Jesus, not to be anti this issue. And let's make sure that that's what comes through loud and clear more than anything else. It was such a good reminder not to get caught up in our hatred or our disdain for what we feel is wrong with the world, but instead celebrate what God has made right in the world. And the other issues can come subordinate to that, certainly. Now, Scott, we were talking before the show about this kind of appeal, and I wonder if this is what motivates Filoni's remarks in the first place. I've got a neighbor with a Darth Vader mailbox, for example. It's popular, I think especially among men, to idealize the dark side, particularly the Sith Lords, Vader chief among them. They might say, well, I'm an Empire guy, right? Why is this? What is so appealing and attractive about the villains?
Yeah, I would say that Darth Vader is probably the most popular character and the most recognizable out of Star Wars, period. People have their favorites.
Maybe in all of Western media.
Could be, very well could be. He's used as examples in things that have nothing to do with science fiction. You know, so I think his reach is very extraordinary. And then some people have romanticized him. Some people have, you know, idealized him. You know, they like his strength, you know, and I think some people do probably do agree with the fact that he brings order. At what cost is a different story, but he brings the order, you know. So I think some people kind of might latch on to that type of ideology.
Okay. Yeah, black and white, right and wrong, and he may be wrong, but at least he stands for something. There's not a gray area there once you get inside the armor. Okay, Kevin, what do you think?
I think Scott touched on this, that strength, the allure of power, which is, within the Star Wars universe, you know, one of the main goals of the Sith, right? I mean, they, you know... That's pretty clear based on everything we know from how they operate. But it's that allure of power and the ability to get what one wants, even if one sees that, like Anakin did, as a way to help others. I mean, you know, his conversation, which has been memed into oblivion with Padme there, you know, where, you know, he wouldn't joke with the senator, you know, that conversation there. Correct me if I'm wrong, but in there somewhere he talks about how people should be made to listen. They should be made to come to these agreements. You know, basically they should be forced to do what is right.
Right. What if they don't agree?
They should be made to agree.
They should be made to agree. That's right. And she says, what you're describing is not democracy. It's dictatorship. He's like, okay, I guess.
I guess I'm a dictator, you know, eventually.
He's like, well, we just need a wise, benevolent ruler. Little did he know that wise, benevolent ruler had taken the same shortcuts and was bound to ruin his life. I think that's a great point. Power is alluring. And I was just teaching on this morning in Bible class in John 18. Jesus is asked by Pilate, are you the king of the Jews? And Jesus turns Pilate's question back at him. And they go back and forth, question, 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 question. And Jesus says twice in this one passage in John 18, my kingdom is not of this world. And all Pilate hears there is Jesus say the words, my kingdom. And he says, aha, so you are a king. Gotcha. Jesus is making a different point, which is, I'm not looking for power. That's not what this is about. Jesus had the ability to overthrow, you know, the mob army that came to arrest him in the garden, and he chose nonviolence. Jesus goes to the cross, he takes the crown of thorns, and in his resurrected state says, all authority on heaven and earth has been given to me. And then he commissions his disciples not to go and overthrow Caesar, but to go and make disciples. Teaches people about the kingdom of God, right? To be baptized in the name of the Father, Son, the Holy Spirit, so forth and so on. Jesus shows us what power looks like in such a countercultural way. And I wonder if people grasp it. I wonder if this is coming through clear enough in our churches. Even just saying the words, "My kingdom is not of this world," felt dangerous for me to say in church. I was just wondering, do we really believe this? That our battle is not against flesh and blood, that our primary agenda here is not about winning an argument over contemporary issues, but we're tapped into a spiritual realm. There's so much more at stake here. Jesus shows us a power in surrendering power. We've talked about that plenty on the show. Another one of these points that comes up in this quote from Filoni is that regarding loneliness. I love this idea that he says, when his life is a wreck, let's see if I can find it, Vader is miserable. He lost everything. He has no one in his life. Absolutely nothing until his son comes back and says, "I love you." We'll talk about the power of love more in a moment. And he speaks to the fact that Vader is lonely. One of the things I think we've done adequately on the podcast is to talk about the importance of Christian community. Now, I know we've got some listeners who, yes, they believe in God. Yes, they want to do the right thing. They want to have a good relationship, but for whatever reason, re-engaging with church is a scary prospect. Maybe it's the post-pandemic world that we live in. A lot of people found themselves not in church. It's easy to get out of the habit. Others, for whatever reason, may have found themselves at odds with their church. Maybe it was over a political issue or whatever the case may be. Somewhere along the line, somebody said something hurtful that they shouldn't have, and it's hard to forgive. One of the beautiful things about Star Wars is it shows us the importance of community, not being in this battle alone. And going back to my friend's Vader mailbox, you know what else is not next to that mailbox? Any other characters from Star Wars. Vader is not standing next to the Emperor with his hand on his shoulder. He's not standing next to Luke. He's not next to Yoda. He's alone. And that's the image that we have of Vader, right? He's always this lone, ominous figure, because he's left with the consequences of his actions, right? And that is, he's by himself. Nobody understands what he's going through until his son believes in him, right? What is so alienating about the dark path, whether in Star Wars or even if we allow ourselves to be consumed by hatred, rage, in a real-world context?
I think part of it might be the mindset of, if I want this thing, then I know you want this thing. So I have to fight you for this. So I can't trust you about this. So I think that's kind of the seeds that the dark side sows, and evil in general,
okay,
is to isolate people and for people to think, you know, everybody wants what I have or what I'm trying to get. And so I can't let people stand in the way, and I can't let this person come up and backstab me, because I know I just backstabbed this other person. I think that's part of the dark side path is is you're alienating everybody else.
Okay, good. So there's greed. There's a selfishness that says it's got to be my way or the highway. You know, in that, so much of trying to navigate good Christian friendships is not easy, but it takes so much ability to say, you know what, I don't see it your way. You may be right. I could be wrong about this. But because I love you, I'm going to listen, and we can have a conversation without getting mad at each other. And at the end of the day, we're going to choose to keep working through this side by side rather than to, you know, give up on the relationship. And that's something that's addressed in the New Testament. I think about Paul telling Euodia and Syntyche in Philippians 4 to agree in the Lord. Agree in the Lord. He doesn't tell them they've got to see eye to eye on the issue, but find some common ground in the Lord. We don't know, you know, the full extent of their conflict. We do know Paul's instruction to them. Yeah, so this selfishness that says it's got to be my way, it's in that same book in Philippians 2 where Paul says, look to each other's interests, not simply to your own.
And I think there's a lot to the phrase, just agree to disagree. Just to say, okay, I understand where you're coming from. I might not agree with it, but, you know, you have your opinion and I have mine. You know, I think there's a lot to you know, I'll share with you my opinions. You share with me yours. And then we'll just go forward from there. Maybe we won't change each other's minds, but we don't have to.
Yeah. Have an ongoing dialogue.
The idea is to stay civil. That's the big thing, which is not impossible, it seems, these days.
I've bumped into that phrase a little bit, and perhaps it's because it's used by our culture in the effort to say you should never tell anyone they're wrong.
I can understand that part of it, and, but I still think there's some value in saying, listen, I understand where you're coming from, but my opinion is valid as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I think what I would want to throw into the mix is, and yes, then find some common ground, especially in the church, find some common ground in the Lord. Like, let's find a way to unite and be on the same page about something. Let's find something that we do agree on, and let's talk about that next time. Or, hey, let's work on something together. Let's do something constructive. We don't have to argue politics, but we can go and build this widow lady a new ramp for her to get in and out of her house. Like, hey, let's work on a project together that's much more productive. That's a great point. You know, even in Leominster, Scott, I had a brother who, he and I had a really tough conversation about our perspectives on race. And at the end of the day, I hadn't convinced him, he hadn't convinced me. But before I left, I just wanted to say, hey, I was grateful for that conversation. And over the last couple of months, it had me thinking differently about my opinion. And I was thinking more critically, was I right on this? Was I wrong on this? Where did I get some of my ideas? And I told him, hey, even though it was one of the more uncomfortable conversations I've ever had, it was important for my journey of faith. It was important that I was challenged on this. And I'm grateful for your brotherhood.
I think that could be important as well, is especially if you're going at these kind of conversations with kind of an open mind, not ready to be convinced somebody else's way, but to see their point of view, maybe that can kind of refocus where you are. And it doesn't have to happen overnight, like you said. It could be something you marinate on for a year, 2 years, maybe even, until you see things.
And I think that's what love looks like. Love listens.
Kevin? I wanted to go back to something real quick that Scott mentioned earlier, and that Jared, you also touched on, the idea that evil isolates people. I think that was the word Scott used. Jared, I think you used the word alienate.
Yeah.
That.
Yeah.
Is theologically absolutely true. And, you know, we've touched on various times about the theological themes and mythological themes from which George Lucas drew to create this world and the characters and motivations and actions and things like that we see them experiencing. But in terms of a Christian perspective on the nature of reality, we've absolutely touched on something that Star Wars agrees with, I believe wholeheartedly, is that evil alienates and isolates people, going all the way back to the opening pages of the Bible, where there in the first two chapters of the book of Genesis, Adam and Eve are there.
Oh, yeah.
They are in God's presence. They are, you know, the people of God, with the presence of God in the place where God is, and they're enjoying this extraordinary relationship where they're learning and growing and they're fulfilling their role as the image of God. And then sin enters, you know, due to their disobedience. The disobedience is their grasping for, you know, running creation in the way that they see fit, which then leads to all this destruction. And what happens to them is that they are removed from God's presence. And it's no accident that in Genesis 3 there, There is a type of angelic figure known as a cherub that, I think there might be two of them, at least, that stand guard. Cherubs in the Bible are not pudgy little, like, cloth-diapered babies with wings, you know, rosy cheeks and, you know, shooting arrows at people, right? That's not a cherub. Like, these are pretty formidable.
They're much more heavy metal. Yeah. They're much more heavy metal, at least when I read
them. They're much, I mean, the flaming sword does it, right? But they're much, you know, they're intimidating figures. But the cherub guards the entrance to God's presence in the garden. You're isolated from God's presence. It's no accident that the very next time that we see cherubs show up in the Bible is that they are seated on top of the Ark of the Covenant, which is the special way for which the Israelites can re-enter into God's presence. And they have to be extraordinarily careful about how to do that, because they can't just roll up into their big mobile temple known as the tabernacle, which is just a fancy tent. They can't just roll up into God's presence any time. His presence is so extraordinary and beautiful, and the Bible uses the term holy, which, you know, specially set apart, that it's dangerous to people who are not able to go into that environment.
Yeah, there's purity rituals and the high priest, and you can't just waltz into the Holy of Holies.
He can only enter God's presence. He can be as close to God's presence as possible one day a year, and he has to go through, like Jared said, these extraordinary rituals for purification and everything like that. And it was still recommended that he needed to wear bells in case he died. Then you could hear that the bells are stopped ringing till he must be dead.
Wow.
Because of something. The whole point of that is to say that the tabernacle, as wonderful as a gift as it was, for the Israelites to be able to look and to say, look, I see the brightness and the glory of God over there, here in our midst. It's right over there across the camp. They're still isolated by these degrees of protection for their own benefit. And all that changed when Jesus came to deal with...
Oh, wow. I didn't think you were going
to deal with
there.
That isolation.
Sure.
And for Vader, what happened was also the Son being willing to reach out.
Oh, sure. All right, we could take it to another level. I mean, Jesus does this in his ministry. Jesus builds these bridges to the isolated, those who are alienated because of sin. I think about Zacchaeus. He's got no friends left. He has so alienated himself, he can't even be in
the
crowd. Absolutely. And Jesus goes and has a meal with him and then requires something of him to make amends. Now, I think about the demon-possessed man in Mark chapter 5, the one possessed with legion, the pigs, and it's a very scary story. He's cutting himself with clay pottery, broken bits of clay, and there's chains and wailing, and people are scared of him. And yet Jesus comes and he treats him like a person. He talks to him. He engages with the monster that nobody wants anything to do with. Jesus finds people in their loneliness, and he offers them community, and he offers them light. You know, he brings light into the darkness, and that's what this is all about. I think it's popular, of course, to conceive of gray areas. I'm a little bit good. I'm a little bit bad. We've all got some dark in us, and it's really not all that bad after all. But the New Testament is much more head-on, aggressive in terms of describing the fact that there is no darkness in Jesus. That's not the way that this story goes. It may be popular in popular culture. Even Captain America is ready to sever Iron Man's head in one of those movies. But that's not the way that this story goes. 1 John chapter 5, that in him there is no... 1 John 1, 5, there is no darkness at all. In him there is no darkness at all. That's different. Even then, Luke Skywalker's got this darkness in him, right? He sees that he's a lot like his father. But the biblical perspective on this is that the light illuminates the darkness. We're brought out of darkness and into light. I think one of the major issues we engage with the topic of the dark side is so many Christians have tolerated their dark side and have embraced their dark side and have tried to mix it with a little bit of the light of Christ. But I think that's missing the picture. What about you guys? I think that there's more transformation offered to us through Jesus than we often embrace. It seems to me that we take a little bit of Jesus, hoping to make him make ourselves just a little bit better people. And yet we kind of treat our dark sides like they're pets, and we pet the sin and hope it doesn't bite us, right?
I mean, I've seen plenty of people who have weaponized the Bible, weaponized Scripture, and used it like a scalpel to attack people. Okay. So I think I know what you're talking about when you're just saying that the, you know, these people who are supposed to be, you know, on one side, but still have some of the other side, and they think that because of one part of it, they can control the other side of it. And just because they say, well, hey, I love Jesus, that gives them carte blanche to be able to do whatever they want, however they want, regardless of the morality of what
hateful.
Is the underlying the underlying intention of what they're trying to do. And they use, like I said, I've seen people use Scripture to try and work the way around whatever they're trying to get across, regardless of if it's contradicting other things or not.
Yeah, Jesus says, many will say to me, Lord, Lord, didn't we do all these great things in your name? And he says, I'll say to you, depart from me, I never knew you. And that's what it comes down to. Do we know Christ? Do we really know him? Yeah, well said, Scott. I've got this opinion, Kevin, that a lot of us tolerate our dark sides and play nice with it and try to keep it on a leash. That doesn't work out so well for characters in Star Wars, does it? Anakin tries to just suppress this. I killed an entire tribe of sand people, but nobody else needs to know about it, and that's really never going to catch up to me, right? Speak to this idea that there's more transformation offered through the light of Christ than I think many of us ever really take seriously.
Yeah. even the Apostle Paul, after experiencing some pretty extraordinary transformation, still finds himself having some very tough moments where he realizes how sinful he is. And is open about that. He doesn't necessarily feel the same shame, or maybe it's not always at the forefront of his mind, when he, you know, in his former life, when he was a persecutor of the church. But he mentions that. And I don't think he completely is doing this just for hyperbole. I think at some point he might actually think that that is the greatest sin and calls himself the chief of sinners at one point. He is willing to see that the great power that God has given him to, to do some pretty extraordinary things. If you read through the book of Acts, you're casting out demons and healing people. And he speaks very openly about the spiritual gifts that he has in terms of prophecy and things like that.
He's kickstarting the early church throughout the ancient world.
So.
He's going from town to town. He's apparently a charismatic speaker enough to draw people's attention and get responses.
Yeah. He's able to do all of that. And yet, it seems like the most impactful lesson that he learns is the complete opposite lesson of the Sith. My power is perfected in weakness, Jesus tells Paul in 2 Corinthians. And that is so backwards. That is so backwards to a secular humanist. position. That's a corruption of a Christian position. You know, or any group might think, you know, in order for our perhaps worthwhile ideals to get out there, the way to do it is to wield power in the traditional ways in which people have wielded power, which is often by threats of force and things along those lines. And Christ's way is just so utterly different. And we touched on this, guys. This is one of my favorite episodes. We touched on this last year, I think, when we talked about surrender and how Luke threw away his lightsaber at the end there. Cap dropped his shield. I'm not going to fight you anymore, Bucky. Jesus has the heavenly hosts at his disposal and lets himself get arrested. That those moments of weakness prompted something within the antagonists to be shocked into realizing that there was something greater afoot than something as crass as might makes right, which is how the emperor operates.
Yeah, you know, that that reference to Paul highlights another story that I'm thinking of where somebody is dealing with their own dark side and they've seen the power of God and God's using them in amazing ways and they so clearly believe that God's able to achieve amazing things through them and he's the one true God and nothing else can compare, and yet is still battling his own darkness, his own dark side. I think about another story, and that's Elijah. Paul's a great example of somebody wrestling with the guilt of their own sin. Elijah's just dealing with loneliness, and he's dealing with fear for the fact that Queen Jezebel, somebody who holds traditional power, right? She's got authority on the political side of things, power and prestige. And Elijah's just embarrassed her. So there's this huge showdown at Mount Carmel in 1 Kings 18. Elijah is victorious in this showdown that is God. Shows up the prophets of Baal. It's an amazing story. One of the most climactic displays of God's power in the entire Bible in 1 Kings 18. The next chapter is a roller coaster of emotion. You know this story, Scott? I don't know if I ever preached on it in Lemonster, where Elijah flees for his life and he goes to a cave and he seemingly, you're welcome to interpret the story differently than me, it seems to me that he's ready to kill himself. He talks about how he wishes his life would end.
At the very least, he's ready to die, and it's obvious.
Yeah. He has fled for his life because Jezebel has basically hired bounty hunters to go out and find him. All right, I'm editorializing the story a little bit. But she's put a hit on his life, and Elijah flees to the wilderness, hides in a cave, prays to God, this is not what I signed up for. And so God then reveals himself, one of these, we call them theophanies, the revelation of God's presence to a person, and it's this wonderful little story. It's great for youth groups especially. It's just a fun little way to come to understand, oh, maybe God isn't who I thought he was and doesn't operate the way that I thought he did. First, what's the pattern there in 1 Kings 19? Do you guys know? There's an earthquake and a whirlwind, and there's fire.
I forget specifically the order, but those are the elements. And then at last he comes in a gentle whisper.
Yeah, so he says, 1 Kings 19:10, I've been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts. So he's telling God, look at all these great things I did for you. The people of Israel have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, killed your prophets with the sword, and I, so here's the loneliness, even I only am left, and they seek my life. There's the bounty hunters, right? They seek my life to take it away. And he said, go out and stand on the mount before the Lord. And behold, the Lord passed by, a great and strong wind tore the mountains. Tore the mountains. Can you think about this? A wind, a whirlwind that tore the mountains, it broke into pieces the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. So this is kind of this repetitive story. After this, an earthquake. The Lord was not in the earthquake. After the earthquake, a fire. The Lord was not in the fire. After that, the sound of a low whisper. So there's a lot to be said there about how God reveals himself, not the most powerful ways we might conceive of, but in something small and quiet and untraditional. I want to highlight the fact that God then gives Elijah a job, he gives him food, and he gives him a friend. Hey, this just became a 3-point sermon. I didn't do that on purpose.
Start with the same letter.
That just happened.
You can't help yourself.
There we go.
Okay, you're such a preacher.
It's on accident. Oh, man. So he gives him a job. He gives him work to do. Hey, your job isn't over. You need to do something productive instead of just sit in this cave and cry. Two, take care of your body. Our bodies are connected to, you know, our spiritual side of things. Don't neglect to take care of yourself. And then he sends him into his community, right? He needed an apprentice. He sent him Elisha. Elijah then trains Elisha. God brought Elijah out of the darkness, out of the cave, into the light, and gave him a friend. Somebody who is his companion, somebody to teach, somebody to share his spirit with. Ultimately, at the end of the day, serving the Lord for Elijah had its dark moments, but was an illuminating experience because it brought him into community. It gave him a friend. And that's one of the beautiful things about church, about God calling us out of sin. It's not just about saving us from this thing we call sin or hell, but out of the darkness of trying to get even with people and make other people look bad when they've done us wrong, or make ourselves, you know, have smaller and smaller circles till we're the only one left because, well, we're right and everybody else is the problem, and I'm going to start preaching if we're not careful. Ultimately, in all of this, the church then serves as our community. We get companions to keep us in the light and, you know, drag us out of darkness from time to time when we find ourselves despairing in the cave. I've got a clip from Dave Filoni. This was an interview we gave a couple of years ago, talking about this very same idea. Scott, I was looking for the exact quote that you had for us earlier. I couldn't find it. If there was an audio clip, I just love Filoni talking Star Wars. It's a beautiful thing to listen to. He's got this kind of high-pitched, nasally voice, but he clearly loves the stuff. And I love it when he's had podcast appearances and that sort of thing. There's something in this little interview. It's 2 minutes long. There's something in this that I want us to touch on. So let's take a listen.
When Palpatine says, the dark side of the Force is a pathway to many abilities some consider to be unnatural. You start to stack that up with the philosophies of the Sith and the philosophies of the Jedi. And see, the Sith believe the ultimate power comes through them being alive and them maintaining themselves and them being immortal and them holding on to power and their life at all costs. They cannot die. Dying is humiliating. Dying is a failure. And I cannot let that go. So we hold on to everything. We build parts for ourselves that are machine because it doesn't matter because I'm still whole because I have my power and I have fear and I control you. And a Jedi says, I need none of that. I need to be completely selfless because I only have power if I'm selfless. If I can cast away everything, be selfless, and say nothing is as important as everyone else and everything else, and I am part of the whole. I would die for my father because I love him so much. That's the most powerful thing to me, and I can redeem you through that, through not holding a lightsaber to you and cutting your head off, but through showing you that your power and your electricity emperor is nothing compared to the power that I hold between my father and I and that compassion. And that is how a Jedi has power, through selflessness, and they let it all go. And then you become one with the Force. So they gain everything by almost having nothing and then existing in the Force, but it's a selfless view of it. And that's the big difference between these two philosophies. And that, to me, ties into, you know, evil and good and Maul and even Luke and all these things.
Now, and what I love about that quote, what I wanted to draw attention to for the sake of the time that we have left in this episode, is, yes, coming out of the dark and into the light, right, light side versus dark side kind of discussion, comes with community. It obviously brings us into a sense of purpose. We find that the dark side is miserable, so we can have joy in our day-to-day life. But another element of this that I wanted to get to is the idea that we have a different perspective on death. The light side, what we're talking about for tonight is Christian spirituality in particular, that Christianity gives us a new perspective on death. In Star Wars, I think Filoni's right. They're so concerned with not dying that, yeah, for Vader, he's barely even human anymore. He's sustained so artificially, and yet he was so afraid of dying or his loved ones dying that he couldn't let go and became the shell of a man. Whereas Luke throws his lightsaber away and says, I would rather die to save you than to strike down this goon of a villain shooting lightning out of his fingers, right? Sacrificial death would be a better way to die than to live with power and evil like you have, right? Now, the Christian perspective on death, I think, is such an important element to this light side, dark side discussion, don't you guys?
Yeah, I think so. I think that I think the key element in this is love and the community that is inherent amongst people who genuinely love each other. It's interesting, Filoni mentioned selflessness there. Selflessness is not the same as non-attachment. And we started to see hints of kind of the worst extreme of non-attachment in, was it last episode of Book of Boba Fett, where Luke lays out to Grogu, you know, the lightsaber or the chainmail shirt, right? And Luke just seems perplexed that he would choose this chainmail shirt and go off and, you know, be with basically his father. Like, how is that surprising?
Yeah.
Based on what happened just not that long ago. I think that was maybe something that Luke hadn't learned yet. It'd be interesting to see where they go with that if they bring Luke back in various D+ shows.
Sure, but it was the appeal of love.
Yeah, it really was. And Filoni has elsewhere said that Qui-Gon would have been able to give that fatherly love to Anakin in order to be the community that he needed. He needed a father and not a brother. And it's all the more poignant when Obi-Wan says, you are my brother, Anakin. Better than nothing, absolutely. You know, not to take any away from, you know, my favorite character in all of Star Wars.
Right, the essential.
But
element of love that the Jedi are struggling to understand. Yeah, the light side is certainly a better way to live. Nevertheless, they're missing something, something huge, and that's love. And that's obviously where we're going tonight, is trying to think of all the different places in the Bible where God is described so clearly as the times where he says, right, God is this, God is that. One of them is love, right? God is love. God is light is something that God is described as. God is spirit. It's John 3. Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. These really clear distillations of this is what this is all about. And light is one of them. That's why I'm so grateful that we've had this conversation tonight. We have a different perspective on death. We have a different perspective on love, right? A love that casts out fear. Now, Scott, did you want to speak to this idea of the Christian perspective on death before we wrap tonight? You're somebody who's struggled with various health issues over the years, but you never seem like, when I talk to you, like your health is the most important topic on planet Earth. Now, you're a person who, at least to me personally, has modeled, you know what, this is not the most important struggle that we're going through. Whether I make it through this, or I, you know, whether I live or die, or am in the hospital, or I'm at home, or if I'm at work, or you know, building Hot Wheels in the garage. There's more to how we live and suffer than just simply being afraid of dying. You want to speak to that?
I've kind of, as far as my personal health goes, I always worry more about the effect it has on everybody else.
I think that's
else.
Selflessness, yeah.
All the extra work my wife has to do to make sure that I'm get to my appointments on time and make sure I'm taken care of and everything. So I always worry about that type of stuff. And I think that speaks more towards the community aspect of the light side. You know, they're always there to try and help each other, answer each other's questions and stuff, instead of, you know, how can I use this person? And I think that's pretty much the big, like, the big difference between them.
I got to go to a seminar recently at Harding University, mine and Kevin's alma mater, and one of our professors, Dr. Phil Thompson, did a bioethics. Has he got a master's or is it a doctorate in bioethics?
He has a master's.
Okay, he's got a master's in bioethics. We did this seminar for preachers to think through really difficult bioethical issues, such as, you know, how do we understand the transgender issue in our culture from a medical and biblical perspective? Abortion was one of them. One of the topics to just close out the show on a real high note was self-assisted suicide. He talked about how do we attend to the dying, how do we pastor people with terminal illnesses, how do we understand this issue that we're grappling with in our culture and the legality of it, and certain number of states have legalized self-assisted suicide, others haven't, and I was thinking through critically an issue that he's worked hard to understand and help us to just get some exposure to, and he brought up this notion that has just stuck with me like white on rice. I mean, it's just, I can't shake it. And the idea was, we talk a lot in our culture, especially if you attend a funeral, if it's an elderly person surrounded by family who's lived a long life, possibly a full life is another term that we use, there's another term that comes up, and that is, we say they lived a good life. They lived a good life. And he asked us, what is a good life? Is it more than just living to be 80, 90 years old? Or is there more to living a good life than how many years we have on Earth? You know, I think, as most of us are thinking right now, I've got Kevin and Scott nodding along here, which is especially helpful on a podcast, guys. They say that Jesus at 33 years old, we can say lived a good life. Yes, he died a cruel, torturous death, but he lived a good life. It was a short life, and obviously we believe is resurrected and is seated at the right hand of the Father eternally. Yeah. Hear me loud and clear on that one. And then Dr. Thompson then bridged the gap to say, well, then what does a good death look like? He was advocating for a brave death that faces suffering and pain, and realizes that possibly self-assisted suicide isn't the way to go, was his point. But he was saying Jesus, even the dying on a cross, hey, that's a good death. It was a good death because his death was with a purpose. He died for the people that he loved. A challenge just to think critically about what is a good life and what is a good death. And Star Wars does that too, right? Vader died a good death despite having lived a terrible life, right? It was a rotten life. It was a good death.
Yeah. Yeah.
How do we understand life and death from a dark side, light side, Christian, un-Christian perspective?
The only thing I really have to go on from this, and I'm still working through this. My father passed away in 2011. So I'm still processing all of that. But he did not take any kind of self-assisted suicide or anything like that. But he did not want any extraordinary measures taken to save his life. He had a tumor. He knew it was coming. And he's like, nope. We had another family member who fought everything, and their family fought everything and threw everything at it for multiple years. And they had strokes, and they had all these other things. And he saw that, and he's like, I'm not going out like that. I'm going out on my own terms, and I'm not going to be first of all, you know, this is where I get a lot of my stuff, obviously, is from my parents. He's like, I'm not going to be a burden on other people And so that's kind of the only perspective I can take.
Our point tonight isn't to shame people for how they or their loved ones are facing some of these critical issues, so much as to say, let's think through critically what does it look like to live a good life and to die a good death and to encounter pain and suffering and obstacles and illnesses for the glory of God, and to do so with joy and to do so lovingly, to do so without being consumed by darkness. It's easy to let obstacles like that lead us into despair and into wanting to drag other people. I think about Job. He says that when he encounters his immense, immeasurable suffering, he curses the day that he was born, the day of his birth. I like to think that he went over to his calendar and he took the thickest Sharpie he could find and he crossed out his birthday. And he said, you know, on this day, we're going to play funeral dirges and everybody, we're not going to celebrate my birthday. We're going to spray fertilizer on the birthday cake. I just want everybody to be miserable. And I think that's a tempting sentiment for us in our culture when we start to experience suffering, is to want to drag others down into suffering with us.
I think you need, as these things approach, we really need to celebrate the life. We really not dwell on, okay, what's coming up or that type of thing, but just celebrate what people mean to us and what impact they've had in us. And that's what I think is really important as you get to those later
stages.
What
is there to live for?
One of you mentioned the word brave, and that really stands out, to face what you're going to have to face with bravery. Yoda has another extraordinarily quotable and, I think, in reality, true line. Fear leads to anger. Anger leads to hate. Hate leads to suffering. And goes on to say, much fear I sense in you. And my goodness, we see that. We see that thread run all the way through episodes 1, 2, The Clone Wars, and episode 3, Anakin's fear of losing those closest to him, when he is afraid that Obi-Wan has been killed. And Obi-Wan does this forgive me for mixing worlds, Polyjuice potion, throw a little Harry Potter in there. Obi-Wan gets this makeover as Rako Hardeen. That's a wild storyline. It is. But he, like, Anakin, like, we get some, I think in the music of the Clone Wars episodes where that happens, we get some Imperial March undertones in there. When Ahsoka is missing, or in like very serious and grave danger, Anakin is, you know, willing to go to any lengths, you know, right or wrong, to get her back. And it's the fear of losing those who are closest to him. Whereas on the other hand, yes, there might be some fear of death and dying, and especially fear of the unknown of what will happen to our loved ones when we pass. I think that's legitimate, because it's a concern for others and what we will leave to them, or rather leave for them to do in our absence, which we would never in a million years want them to have to do in our absence. But to be able to bravely face it and with that bravery encourage and strengthen those around us. There was an elder at the church where I grew up. He was 55. And when I was in high school, I thought 55 was old. And now that I'm 36, 55 is not that old.
It's not as old as it used to be.
That's exactly right. But there was an elder at our church. And for those who aren't familiar with how our churches are in, elders are kind of like your, you know, like spiritual, like overseers, or, you know, like the folks who are, you know, generally thought to be wisest and and so on in your church. And he was 55, so young for an elder. Had been an elder for a while, very well respected businessman in the community, in the suburbs of Nashville where I grew up. And he'd had, I can't remember, some kind of cancer or heart disease or something along those lines, but they decided that it was not, they were not going to throw everything at it, like you had said earlier, Scott. And bravely, there on his deathbed in his house, all of the other church staff and leadership, and even the youth group, even the teenagers and high schoolers and middle schoolers who knew him because of his work with our summer youth camp, we were allowed to go there. And we saw him kind of bravely face the situation. And my youth minister likes to tell this story where he remembers being in that moment just extraordinarily overwhelmed by everything and was feeling, you know, feeling the weight of it all crushing in on him. And he was beginning to feel like he was the only one bearing this weight, isolated, despite being in a room full of people. He was feeling it come crushing down on him until one other person there simply placed their hand on his shoulder. And he said he just felt like the whole world came back to him, and he realized, I'm not alone. I'm here. And I can be with these folks. And what Vader needed was a hand on his shoulder, not not a lightsaber at his throat.
Yeah, I think we see the manipulation of Palpatine putting that hand on his shoulder when he was a young man and saying, I believe in you. And that really comes full circle to say that, unfortunately, the one person who really did come alongside him as a fatherly figure did not have his best interests at heart. And so but we wouldn't have the Star Wars without it, and so I'm grateful that it's there, and it's a cautionary tale. And it does live a terrible life, but it does end well. It's a good death, I think. And so a beautiful testament to everything we've talked about tonight, rejecting the dark, living in the light. And really enjoyed this conversation. Now, Kevin, you got me thinking about that conversation with Luke and Yoda on Dagobah, and he says, luminous beings are we. I don't know, hey, it's not as good as Kevin's impression, but luminous beings are we, not this crude matter. And that's what the light side is all about. We really are. God has made us in his image and luminous beings, I think in a different way than George Lucas had in mind. Luminous in the sense that we reflect the light of Christ, and we've got a job to do. So go out into the world this week. I've really enjoyed making this episode. Guys, good, always good catching up with you. That's going to do it for this week. Thank you, everybody, for listening to Hyperspace Theology. Got some fun stuff happening on our other pet projects. I will say a little personal plug. We've got my other Star Wars show, Legends Look Back. We are celebrating this week our 100th episode. 100th episode of Legends Look Back. Been making it since 2019. We're celebrating this week. I've even asked my other co-host to wear formal attire for the 100th show. We'll be launching it Thursday night, 9:30 p.m. Eastern time on Utini, youtube.com/Utini. So very excited about that one. Would love for Legends Look Back listeners to know about it. Join in. If you give me a shout-out, tell me you heard about it through Hyperspace Theology. I'll give you a shout-out live on air. Kevin, now you've got some fun stuff going on with Faith in the Folds. Why don't you tell the good folks what you've got going on over there?
That's right. There is a terrible shortage of ministers in churches across America. And so I have got an upcoming podcast episode with Dr. Carson Reed out of the Seibert Institute for Churches from Abilene Christian University in Abilene, Texas. I'm going to talk with him. I'm going to talk with Dr. Candace McQueen, president of Lipscomb University in Nashville, Tennessee, about the state of Christian higher education. And I'm going to talk with Dr. A.J. Swoboda from Bushnell University about his book that I used for a class earlier this year, After Doubt, which is a book about dealing with doubt and moments, periods, seasons of deconstruction in one's faith journey. So we've got a couple of neat episodes coming up on the podcast that I'm excited to record those and get those out here in the next few weeks.
Oh, cool. Wow, that sounds great. Remember, of course, we'd like to hear from you. You can submit an episode topic, give us listener feedback, all sorts of things, by emailing us at hyperspacetheology@gmail.com. And, of course, we're over on Instagram as well. We'd love to for you to give us some likes, some comments, and all that good stuff over there as well. Remember, everybody, we will be back soon with another episode. In the meantime, God bless, and may the Force be with you.